I think clearly things are moving faster than ever. And I think you have to learn how to learn. That's basically, I would say, to learn more efficiently. I think it's a key and embrace the change. It's even if you think that this change will hurt you, right? Because it's going to take away a bit from your expertise, from what you are doing well. But you need to embrace it and run towards it because the alternative is going to be even less optimal.
Welcome to the Data Tea, our monthly podcast on the news, trends, and technology transforming data today. We're your hosts, Armand Petrosian and Satish Jayanthi, the co-founders of Coalesce. Let's get started.
Hello, hello. There we go. We should be all set here. We've got a really incredible guest. I'm happy to make a quick intro. My name is Armand Petrosian, CEO, co-founder of Coalesce. We've got Satish, a co-founder and CTO of Coalesce. But the star of today is a gentleman here named Jan Stoica. I'm pretty sure I pronounced that correctly, Jan. It's such a pleasure to have you on. And for anybody who doesn't know Jan, you're a pretty big profile, man. You're the executive chairman of Databricks. You've been involved in some of the world's largest and most successful open source projects. Sounds like some major commercial platforms between Apache Spark, Ray with Anyscale. I would just love a quick intro, Jan. How did you get here in the first place? How did you get started? And welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here. And well, you know, I've been, as a short introduction, I am from Romania. I came here. I got my PhD from Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh. Then I came to Berkeley as a faculty. Almost like right now, 24, 25 years ago. And at Berkeley, I work on a bunch of open source projects, and some of them are more successful than others. And I've also been involved in starting a few companies. The most known, it's Databricks.
And yep, most of these very well known. Yeah, very well-known company. Satish and I were just at the annual Databricks conference for the first time, and it was an absolutely electric event. There was great attendance, tons of enthusiasm, great keynotes, very polished. So yeah, you should be really proud about what you've started and how far it's come. Congratulations. It's great
thank
to have you
so
on.
Much. And thanks for attending the conference.
Yeah, absolutely. It was fun to be a sponsor. So can you talk a little bit about what inspired you into going into this whole space? Like, was it, I mean, certainly you've got a great technical background and you've worked in academics, but like, how do you go about determining, is this going to be a project that's supposed to be a commercial project? Is it an open source project? Is it usually both? Like, what motivates you to create a solution in the first place?
Great question. So what motivates me about working and to on a solution in the first place, it's obviously the problem. So I am excited about problems, you know, probably that's why I'm in academia first and foremost. So I love to solve problems. So then the question is about, there are many problems to solve. So the main question is about which problems you are choosing to solve. And, you know, in my career, I did my PhD actually in networking. The internet back then was everything everyone was talking about. And then driven by the problems I liked to solving, I moved on then peer-to-peer also is very popular in these days. And then data and now more AI, always from a perspective of from the viewpoints of the infrastructure, right, for this kind of different workloads. That kind of was my focus. Yeah.
Did you say peer-to-peer was a big focus prior to that? Like peer-to-peer?
Immediately after my PhD, which was again in, I did it in networking, I did peer-to-peer for a few years. That
That's
will be part
awesome.
of them.
Yeah,
Yeah.
you're mentioning peer-to-peer networking where you're moving videos with video streaming,
That's
right?
correct.
Is that, yeah, okay.
Yes, that's correct.
That's awesome.
So it's similar to like how YouTube it operates now, or was it more like, I don't know if you remember Napster, LimeWire, like
Yeah,
some of these like peer-to-peer.
That's Napster, BitTorrent, thing like that, but it was for video. Actually, that was the first company I co-founded, was Conviva. And that was
Wow.
about quality video distribution and real-time monitoring and observability.
Yeah, as an avid music lover, I spent a ton of time on all those peer-to-peer networks in my early days. And it's been fascinating to watch how the music industry has unfolded. I know this isn't a podcast for music, but it's been fascinating to see companies like Spotify merge and make the whole streaming industry evolve for musicians. But it's cool that you were on the tip of the spear. That was it was a really interesting time back then. I'm curious, you've worked on a ton of open source projects, and I think oftentimes open source organizations can have some struggles with having success commercially. And so I'm curious, on your side, what was unique, or how did you approach Databricks to create such a successful commercial business from a foundation open source company?
So again, we started to work on many of these open source projects, which is that we are driven by trying to solve a particular problem before Spark was actually Mesos, which was a precursor of Kubernetes. That's an open source project, which was successful for a while, but eventually Kubernetes took over. So with Spark, the problem we're trying to solve at that time, actually it was to run machine learning at that time, scalable machine learning applications, and also to get much quicker answers to your queries, and to run your jobs much quicker. And that was in the default solution back then for big data analytics. It was, of course, Hadoop, right?
Yep.
And Hadoop was scalable, was resilient, but it was reasonably slow because it always reading the data and storing the data on the disk. People were asking at that time, how can we get more interactive queries? How can we apply this to scalable machine learning? And Spark was solving that problem. And the main idea, as you obviously know, it's about storing the data instead of the disk in memory, and do so while still maintaining fault tolerance.
Yeah, I remember the tagline. Yeah, it was 100 times faster. That's what it was.
In memory, you are going to be much faster, yeah. And then, you know, the project we are working actually very closely, and even before Spark, we worked and collaborated on Hadoop to developing some of the features of Hadoop, in particular the scheduler. And then Spark starting to get more traction. And it was a point at which people starting to ask about, people meaning companies using it, were starting to ask about what is the future of Spark, right? Should I commit to it? What happens when the students like Matei and so forth are going to graduate? So that was kind of the question. And obviously, you want to solve these problems also to have an impact, right? To help people to do things, some of the things a little bit better. And initially, actually, we want to see whether one of these Hadoop companies can take over the open source. Right, we are not thinking to start a company initially. But the one we talk with, they have their internal projects, and then that's when we decided to start a company. That was Databricks.
Incredible. And as you started the company, so you looked for somebody who could basically house the open source project externally, but made the decision that you would be better off taking it on yourselves.
Because we couldn't find someone, to take over.
Nobody Spark. Wanted it. Nobody yeah. wanted it. That's crazy exactly. to think about.
Yeah. Again, it means that in his ideas, but at that time,
yeah,
it was yeah. still
at that time nobody knew.
Academic project and so forth, you know. Yeah.
Wow. Speaking of which, it's interesting. Our board member, I think, was one of your students at one point, Shelley. Is that correct?
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. Shelley yeah. Zhang. Yeah.
That's great awesome. Student. So when you did decide to pursue it and start Databricks, what was, like, do you remember a very clear turning point where you thought to yourself, oh, this could be huge, this could become what it is today?
Well, actually, I remember that I was the CEO for the first couple of years between 2013 yeah. and 2016. And I remember that we around the founders, we had this kind of meeting in which go around the table and say, okay, how big you think this can be? And I don't remember all the numbers, but I thought, you know, I think that the highest or like, oh, you know, it's like 200, 300 million, that would be fantastic.
Now mean, you've raised a round I'm that's way bigger not, than that.
I'm in valuation, not revenue.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah,
but at yeah. that time, again, at that time, it was, you know, the biggest, this was 2012, 13, we started in 2013. But at that time, if you think back, the biggest company in the open source, the biggest one by far was Red Hat. Yeah. And then there are a few other companies, but none of them at that time had a valuation. I think MySQL had a valuation like $1 billion when it was sold. And then the other one, even whole cloud, there are Horton, there are less than $1 billion. So, you know, if you look at that, it wasn't that crazy, the numbers we are thinking about at that.
Yeah, it was all relative, right? So people are going around and trying to think of something that's reasonable, but clearly it surpassed everybody's wildest imaginations. Was there any like key customer or anybody that at any certain juncture where you felt like the business really started to take off that you recall in the early stages?
Yeah, I think we make a few bets more or less because maybe we are not doing we didn't know what we are doing at that time. But our bet was obviously on the cloud and then to build a tool for the data scientist. Right? That's kind of bet. You know, data scientists are not many at that time, but we saw that the number is going to grow significantly as all these kind of universities are starting to add degrees for data scientists. And so we build this, you know, notebooks and integrated experience with managing Spark. And we work on that for a while. And I remember, you know, starting in 2013, we had that demo. We have these summits, right? Right. And Spark was starting to be very popular. And right. we had the summit in 2014, and that was, we gave a demo, actually. Ali gave a demo, he was leading the engineering at that time. And nice. It was very, very well received, the demo. Now, we are very far from having what we are demoing, because this was kind of, you know, integration, and you are going to do everything kind of from ingestion to analytics, and also you have a dashboard. And we did that on the Twitter firehose. At that time, you could have access to that. And we get, you know, a lot of people saying, well, when is it going to be available and so forth. So that was a good sign initially. Of course, you don't know that you have product market fit until people are buying it. Now, to take a step back, you know that you have some product market fit because Spark is popular, right? So right. Spark is popular and you have an open source is popular because people use it and people use it because it solves some of their problems. Otherwise, they wouldn't use it, right? Now the question is about, can you generate revenue? So that was a harder question. So we knew actually at least that we had enough people who kind of, they were excited, right?
Yeah.
And then we released in the next summit, it was June 2015, we released a product. And in the meantime, what we knew, I had mentioned to you about this previous company I had, Conviva. We had some kind of beta customers, and so forth. One of the primary ones was Conviva, because they are doing, you know, a lot of analytics and observability on the video streams. And you know, I knew a little bit on the both sides. I knew that it's, you know, these people are using it from Conviva. It brings real value, especially early on. There are always a lot of bugs, and you know, people still using it despite all of this kind of horrendous experience. You know, it's a good start. And then we started in 2015. We released it. And in a 6 months or so, we got a lot of customers, you know, over 200 customers we signed. Now, the problem was, the challenge initially was these customers were, you know, they are small, right?
Yeah.
You have a lot of customers, but it was very different, actually, from other people, because Spark was open source, and other like Cloudera was selling at EMR. AWS was doing or selling Spark, you know, hosting Spark. And especially they had much bigger contracts because they are, in particular, say, companies like Cloudera, because, you know, they have on-prem and they have million-dollar contract, a big contract, right? It's $1 million. While ours, you know, we are selling, you know, 15K, 17K kind of deals, right, initially.
Yeah.
But very fast, the deal size started to grow, and the net retention very high, and that's kind of, you knew that, you know, it's pretty good. But it's still, you know, it like always was open source, why should I buy your product, and things like that, and then adding more and more value. But we you know, it's, I think we are maybe reasonably lucky in the sense that we didn't pivot significantly, you know, during our
journey. It sounds pretty easy to follow. So you basically, you had a very successful open source project, and then Ali demoed what you were thinking about releasing, and then you actually rolled it out a year later at the next conference and pretty rapidly got adoption. I'm sure 200 customers at 15 or 17K is a lot more overhead than two or three big customers at $1 million. So I would imagine your hair was on fire for a period of time.
It was. And then we hired Ron Gabrisco, who was actually, but we didn't, you see, we didn't have a lot of people to know how to do the enterprise sales. That was in the second half, toward the end of 2015, you know, he came and he was, you know, he was an enterprise guy. And I remember this kind of, it wasn't him, it was, I think, another person, her team, which was leading customer success. The way he was explaining it, oh, you know, it's like the easiest way to get to 1 billion revenue, you know, you have 1,000 customers each 1 million, right? So it seems pretty tractable at that level.
It's that easy. It's that easy, man. You just need $1,000 million customers. That's all.
So you know, and
So if you could, obviously, it's been a very successful journey, and you've gone through a lot over the course of, you know, over the past decade at this point. If you could go back into the early stages and give yourself some advice when you were CEO, or even to one of the other co-founders, what would you say in retrospect, looking back now?
I think a few things. Although you feel that you move very fast in a startup, you never move fast enough. You can always move faster. You can always iterate faster. I think that's one. I think the second thing it will be about hiring. I think that you want to bring expertise and filling the gaps. It's always not too early, but also not too late. You tend to be like, people coming from academia, all of us being, put a lot of value on people being smart, right? And you always say, oh, I'm starting this company. I don't know a lot of business and so forth, but hey, I'm smart, so I'm going to figure it out. And it's true, you can figure it out to some extent, but it takes time. And you early on, we always have this kind of things. Oh, we are going to hire these smart people, and they are going to figure it out like we figure it out. But that's a better approach. It's actually to hire some people who have done it successfully before, which seems obvious in retrospect. And another thing which I realize is that it's actually people who have done it and they were before, they are also easier to manage, right? Than these kind of kids which are never managed, right? So I think that's all the things I would do differently. I think, maybe you could, in terms of the product, I think looking back is hard to see. We could have done data engineering a little bit earlier. These are kind of hard. We could have started to add value to a proprietary value to Spark a little bit earlier, maybe. But these things are always hard because it's hard to anticipate the dynamics, especially in the open source, which is a community, and it's very hard to, I think. So I don't know. I think I would like to. I would have loved to experiment with it. But I'm not 100% sure that other choices would have been necessarily better.
It makes sense. I'm curious. So, between all the open source projects that you developed to solve some problems and the problems that you've observed, what problems continue to grow? Are there any trends or issues or challenges that you're observing that you're really interested right now for solving for tomorrow?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think if you look at the trends, so a few of them. So one on the system side, and on the system sides, it's basically the applications are growing in complexity, and the demands are growing. And we have training now, you have inference, now you have post-training. And the shape of these workloads is becoming more and more complex, no question about it. So the complexity of the workload grows, scale of the workload grows. At the same time, because of that, the infrastructure complexity is growing, right? Because you can no longer run all your workload on one machine, so you need to run the workload on different machine, on multiple machine, on a cluster. So it's a distributed computing. But now, also to bridge the gap between the demands of the workload and the capabilities of the hardware, you see more and more accelerators, GPUs, hardware accelerators, right? So now you need to run a workload which is becoming more and more complex on an infrastructure which is distributed and heterogeneous, right? So on multiple dimensions, the problem becomes much harder. So I think that, building systems would make it easier for the developers to build efficient applications at scale on these infrastructures. Efficiency, obviously, is one of the main names of the games because it's very expensive. I think that's going to continue to be a big push, and we are going to see quite a bit of innovation. If you think about Spark, was about a particular more about data parallel workloads, right? Just try scale. Ray is a bit more general, lower level for machine learning, deep learning applications. But I'm sure, you know, and VLLM what we build is for inference. But you are going to see more and more, and you are going to see more kind of, I think, vertically integrated software stacks, right? In order, because by vertical integration allow you to do it, to optimize more efficient. But then, of course, you have problems with modularity. That's kind of what makes it hard, the balance between modularity and vertical and performance, right? So that's now, one angle.
Okay. Yeah. I was going to ask, I know you and Satish were behind the scenes, you were talking about AI, and obviously Databricks has done a ton to focus on AI use cases and initiatives. In general, are you an optimist when it comes to AI, when you look forward in the next 3 to 5 years?
I'm an optimist in the sense that I think that the positives are going to far outweigh the negatives, right? That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I'm not a doomer in that sense. So in that sense, I'm optimist.
Okay.
I do think that, it only be, on the other hand, we still have a long way to go to make, to have AI applications really useful on a broad set of use cases. We already have them useful on a very important set of use cases, but if you want to expand, to broaden their appeal and their usefulness, that will be challenging. And this brings me to the second, because you asked me about the problems and which I think are important. I think one of the most important challenges of AI is reliability, right? Mm-hmm. You have, trusting the outputs, the answers given by these AI applications. That's in my mind, it's one of the main challenges. And it's like systems, like software systems, right? If you think about, If you guys build a lot of the software systems, and it's typically easy to build a prototype to demonstrate, right? But it's harder to productize this feature, that feature.
Yeah.
Right. Takes much more time, much more resources, a lot of debugging, testing, a lot of more iterations. Now, similarly, the same is similar in the case of AI. Right, but I think it's even harder. It's easier to build great demos and demonstrate the features, right? Capabilities. But taking that and productizing it is hard, right? Because it has to be reliable. It is not demoing your feature or a capability means to find a very impressive, example. And I'm going to demo, right? But if I go to the production, it has to work for all use cases, right? For all the inputs and things like that. And that's hard, right? It's from, in some aspects, like I mentioned, it's harder than building a software system, because your software system is more white box, right? You can look at the code, maybe identify the line of code, which is the problem, you can change it and you solve the problem. But a large language model is much more of a black box. It's much harder to isolate the problems and to fix them.
Yeah. So one question. So what kind of guidance would you provide to technical leaders who are building these AI apps then? Like, what should they be focused on, and how do they approach this?
I think that right now, definitely, so where are they are successful right now, obviously, it's code assistants, like, obviously,
like a cursor or something?
Cursor and so forth. This is very successful. Customer support applications and so forth. I think what this they have in common, they have a human in the loop, right? Mm-hmm. So is code assistants, a human eventually approve the suggestions of these large language models, right? Mm-hmm. And so the human validates, right? Or should validate, right? Sometimes people are too happy to click accept, accept.
Okay.
But I think that's kind of the way to for now. Also, because we are talking about reliability, in that case, a human is responsible and accountable for providing reliability. And these tools are great because it can improve that human productivity, right? So all of it is great for everyone. Now, you also need to look at about when these tools are going to fit naturally in the user workflow, right? Again, for a developer, they do fit because they are part, you know, they are extension of their ideas, right? Development environment. Right, it's already there. It's just an extension. Maybe you know for BI, you know, tools is the same thing as an extension. So for anyone who's kind of right, interact with this kind of creating dashboards or writing some code, or I think it's very natural. It's in their workflow. You have the human in the loop. It accelerates some kind of steps in their workflow. I think that's kind of great, and we should continue to push on that. And now, if you are going to start doing this kind of automatic, right, trusting them for automated decisions, then you should look at domains for which you have a very good way to verify the outcome, the output of these large language models. That's why you see a lot of progress in domains where you can do that, like problem solving or coding. I'm talking about these reasoning models.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, and one, just another question on the data space itself. I know we, Armon and I, we are focused on the data. We are a data company. Do you see anything, whether it's AI related or not, but some kind of foundational shifts that are happening in how companies leverage or use the data, how they build their data systems, that people are not thinking about today?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think that, let me put, you know, there are many angles. And, you know, it's like I'm going to say something, you know, obviously about, you know, obvious all these efforts, Databricks, always the vision was from day one at Databricks was we help users, customers, get maximized value out of their data, right? That was our goal to this day. And, you know, accessing for access to the data, to all their data, you see these lake-based announcements and obviously lake house before to try to provide as much as possible uniform open interfaces to access all the data. Then your Unity catalog provide governance, so then give you access to even more data because people let you to access the data if they can put you know, the access rules into place. And then getting value of the data is kind of more analytics and the AI. I think right. That one thing I would say it, modulo that, one trend, I think that you are going to have a tighter loop between the data and the applications, right? You are going to have, and you are going to use data to build applications, some of them based on the language model and so forth. But then they are going, based on their output, you are going to constantly iterate and, you know, retrain the models, post-train the model, and things like that, constantly improve the application performance. Right. So I think that's kind of probably you are going to see more and more.
That makes sense. We got time for one last question, Jan. It's been such a pleasure having you on. For data professionals today, if you could give them one piece of advice, some parting words, anybody who's working in the data industry as a practitioner, what would you say to them?
I think clearly things are moving faster than ever. And I think you have to learn how to learn. That's basically what I would say, so to learn more efficiently. I think it's a key, and embrace the change. It's even if you think that this change will hurt you, right? Because it's going to take away a bit from your expertise, from what you are doing well. But you need to embrace it and run towards it, because the alternative is going to be even less optimal.
Yeah, it's funny. Satish and I were talking about this earlier this week, the exact same thing. But there's two things that I'm left with, Johan, from this conversation. One is you can never go fast enough. And two is to embrace the change. So it's certainly been a pleasure having you on. And congratulations on such a successful career and so much more to come. It's really amazing. Thank you so much.
Good luck. You are doing great things there. So good luck. Cool. And looking forward to read more and more about you and for a stronger and stronger partnership with Databricks.
Love it. Yeah, have a great weekend, Jan. Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye.